Okay, I'm going to call us to order. We don't have a quorum yet. We'll get started with some business. Person Gunther, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, I have an amendment as soon as I can get a hold of it. It is the A1 amendment to House File 1669, which is the governor's bill that addresses housing and Assessor's Deed, Dolly, quite a few other institutions. So I would like to move a technical amendment.
We don't have a quorum yet.
That's fine.
So why don't we present the bill, and then as soon as we do, we'll get it moved.
Okay, members, you have heard all of this bill already through the various descriptions of the stimulus package. What the amendment does is it puts the stimulus package into this bill. And since you've already heard them all, I figured that what we would do in housing and Deed, Dolly, and the other departments in this, I think the Historical Society, you've heard that wouldn't apply to this committee, the Historical Society, but it's in this bill. You've heard all the information from Commissioner McElroy and others. So I would suggest that maybe instead of going through all of that again, we simply have a whole bunch of people that are experts in the various departments here that would be glad to answer any questions you still have regarding these various departments.
Okay, I think we have a quorum now, Representative Gunther. If you'd like to move the bill and then the amendment, please.
I would like to move the bill, House File 1669. I'd like to see for possible inclusion. However, if we do approve this bill, I don't want to put it that you wouldn't have to be here anymore this year in this committee, but we certainly wouldn't have any reason to be here because this is a governor's bill for this committee. And if we approve that, we don't have any input in here, and I don't think any of you want to do that. So with that, I would like to move the A1 amendment that puts the stimulus bill into this bill, and I think it's very appropriate that we do that here. And it certainly has a big impact on the bill.
Okay. And it does have implications for higher education, too. Is that?
I believe it does.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions about the amendment? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion carries. To the bill.
Okay. Now, members, like I said, you've already heard all this information already. What I'm asking, if you have any questions pertaining to the governor's bill for the various departments covered by this committee. And if you do, I have a panel of experts here that just would love to answer all your questions. Tim, I'm expecting a few from you.
Any questions, members?
I have comments, but I don't have questions.
That too, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mahoney?
I disagree with the governor's bill.
Seeing no other questions or comments,
precisely put.
We'll vote on the bill. All those in favor? Oh, we're just laying it over. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Laying over. Possible inclusion.
Okay.
That means we can steal from the bill all we want.
Okay. All right. So, Representative Gunther renews his motion to lay over the bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank all these people here that were here to help me answer the questions.
Okay, we have something that we have to fix. I'd like to move to reconsider the motion referring to Senate File 684 to the Finance Committee last week, and we need to move to refer Senate File 684 to the General Register. Oh, first we have to do that. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Watch me more closely. So first, move to reconsider. shoot the joint. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, what can you remind us again what is 684?
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
I'm pretty sure that the bill that allows more Minsky systems to accept bonding money for bioscience. I'm correcting that. And we heard it late in the evening, and we picked up a Senate file and passed it to finance, and then we did the other one, and we got it messed up, and we have to get it over to wherever we're sending it. I think the floor. Because one of the Minsky systems is waiting for a $400,000 grant from DEED to start a process up in Moorhead, particularly in Moorhead.
So the two campuses of Mankato and Moorhead, is that right?
Yeah. There's a few campuses. Okay. The first one on the list is Moorhead right now.
Okay. Any other questions before we... All those in favor of the bill, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Now we have to move to refer Senate File 684 to the Federal Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. And we'll have Resident Brainerd introduce her bill, House File 1048.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, I can move House File 1048 to be held over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that correct motion?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Well, so moved. House File 1048 extends unemployment benefits, and many of you have heard this bill a couple of times, so I'll be brief and allow time for questions, but it extends unemployment benefits to workers with reduced hours who participate in targeted training through the WIRED federal grant program. This extension is offered as a variation of the shared work plan in Minnesota Statute Section 268.135. There are three main aspects to the bill. The first is the experience of a high technology business in the current economic downturn. It was the experience of one such company, VTech Incorporated in Mankato, that designs and manufactures component processing equipment that became the initial impetus for this bill. The layoffs that accompany a business slowdown highlight the importance of high-tech workers and the team-building process to innovative economic development. This bill was a strategy to help protect some of those workers and the teams of which they are a part. The second element is the shared work plan, which was created in 1994 to reduce layoffs. And the third is the WIRED program, which is a federal grant designed to build talent in rural Minnesota to support the renewable energy industry. We have with us today Lee Nelson to testify on the shared work program, and we also have Teresa Kitteridge if there are any questions on the WIRED program. And I'll turn it over to Lee, who will identify himself and inform us on the shared work program.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. I want to say that we work with Representative Briner on drafting this bill. The department is in full support of this bill. We would like to make the WIRED program a success, and we believe the shared work component will, in fact, do that. What happens is there's a WIRED grant made available to various companies to provide training to incumbent workers. And what happens, of course, if they have to take the day off, they don't get paid. This would allow them to receive partial unemployment benefits for those times they are in training. We believe that's the best way for these people to maintain their employment and maintain a skilled workforce out in greater Minnesota. So that's why the administration is in full support of this bill. And it just brings flexibility to the current shared work program. The shared work program currently, and there are other bills to modify the program, but currently the shared work program requires a minimum number of participants. This would be able to weigh that. It says it doesn't apply to salaried employees. This would allow us to waive that so we can tailor the shared work program to fit to the business which has obtained this wired grant, which would be providing training to incumbent workers.
Okay. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carries. And you have another bill, Representative Bynack, is that right?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have one testifier and some other experts and residents who will be available, but I'll begin by introducing the bill.
Okay, very good.
This is House File 1941, members, and it addresses basic extended employment. The other night I did have an extended employment bill that addressed mental illness, and it's really a different type of supported work program, so this is the broader basic extended employment program. This bill funds extended employment at $13,159,000 each year of the biennium. This is a 5% increase over current funding. There is an argument to be made for this increase, and you have some literature at your that has just been handed out that embodies some of that argument, and our testifier may speak to this in a moment also. But the real argument is to keep extended employment whole. Basic extended employment provides funding for both supported and center-based employment to those with severe disabilities through a statewide network of 30 community rehabilitation programs. Supported employment provides ongoing support for persons working in the larger community in a variety of employment settings. Center-based employment provides ongoing support for persons who work in manufacturing, service, and retail enterprises operated by the community rehabilitation program. Through this program, these individuals contribute to their own support with earned income. Without this program, most of these individuals would require additional support through state and or county services. This program is a win for everyone. It provides employers with qualified employees at a competitive wage, and it helps these workers retain some level of independence. I'd like to introduce Wally Waranka. Is that correct, Wally? Waranka. Wally Waranka, who is a job counselor with LifeTrack Resource Vocational Employment Program. Wally has over 20 years of experience in the field and is highly regarded by his peers and clients and will give us an inside view of the program.
Representative Bynack, before you, we hear from the testifier, I don't think you moved the bill. I'd like to introduce it.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 1941 to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion.
Very good. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Yes, my name is Walter. My name is Walter Waranka, W-A-R-A-N-K-A. And Mr. Chair and the representative, I'm grateful to have this opportunity to come forth in front of you to speak a little bit about the Extended Employment Program, EE. As was mentioned, I am currently working as an employment specialist for LifeTrack Resources, have been with the organization for over 12 years, and in the field, as mentioned, for 20 years, helping individuals with disabilities to find and to maintain competitive employment out in the community and at workshops. I'm here also representing my agency as a member of the MACRO organization, the Minnesota Association of Community Rehabilitation Organizations. We're 29 members throughout the state of Minnesota. But what I'm really here for is to speak on behalf and about individuals with disabilities, as you may have noticed, as myself am one also. The Extended Employment Program is a job program that is very important, I feel, to the continuation of bringing people with disabilities more into the community and being active full participants within our society. Currently, there are 6,200 people being served by the EE program, and this contributes to the state of Minnesota being one of the leaders in the area of people with disabilities being competitively employed. 65% of people in this state who are disabled are working. The national average is 49, which really says a lot for the state and why we're very proud to be part of Minnesota with our activities and our abilities to move forward the advancements for people with disabilities. One little quick story I'd like to just share with you of what the EE program means to my clients and to myself is I work more on the area of helping persons with disabilities to keep their jobs. And I had a gentleman who just recently I received on my caseload, has a history of wanting to walk off jobs. He actually did walk off one job. He has diabetes. He has bipolar and schizophrenia going and some depression. He called me up just yesterday and was very upset. He was currently working as a janitor at one of the retail stores, and he was getting pressure from one of the front-end managers, plus the bathrooms where he was cleaning, they had the speakers up real loud, cranking in music and announcements that were going on over the stores, which was affecting his ability to maintain his job and do his job well. We spent time talking about the issues. He did a lot of yelling. He did a lot of screaming to me. No, not to the supervisors or anyone else, but to me. We talked it through. I offered to be able to go come out and speak with his supervisors, to come out and be a go-between, a negotiator for him. He wanted me to at first to do such, but through our process of talking it all through, he made the determination that he was going to handle it. We came up with a plan. He called me back this morning, said everything is fine. He's working it through, and we're going to continue on helping him maintain this job. And one of the other things that the EE program really stresses and we work towards is making sure that the individuals who are working do advance and also may find opportunities for more work hours. So it's a continuing program, not just to keep work, but to help people to maintain and to advance within the job by whether it's the same benefits, same opportunities for someone to advance, or it would be within looking for some more hours somewhere else if possible or need be. Some of the information was already mentioned by representatives, and you have it in front of you in some sheets, so I encourage you to look those over about what's being looked for and requested and such. But I wanted to close by saying that one of the most important things I feel that happens in our society that we really base ourselves on, and I'm sure many of you can relate to this, where when you meet somebody for the first time, you shake hands or whatever, give a high five, whatever you want to do, smile, introduce yourself, and what usually is the next question that's asked you? What do you do for a living? And for many people with disabilities in the past, you've never been able to answer that question. You've never been able to say what you do for a living. What is your job? But through this program and other efforts, we are giving many individuals with disabilities the opportunity to be able to answer that question and say, this is what I'm doing. This is why I am part of this state of Minnesota, because I have the opportunity to do such. If we keep working with EE, look to advance it, to bring more money into the program instead of cutting the program, we'll be able to keep more Minnesotans on the tax roll, contributing to helping to figure out and to participate in keeping the budget deficit from going up by being active taxpayers, and also keeping them from having to utilize other resources and programs within the state that could bring more burden onto the budget. So I encourage you to look at this proposal, look at the opportunity to increase the money, and I thank you for your time for listening.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions for the testifier or for Brent Binder? Seeing none, Representative Binder renews her motion to lay over and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair and members.
Representative Dabney has House File 1116, and would someone like to move his bill? Representative Gunther. Where would you like this bill to go, Representative Dabney?
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that it could go to the General Register. I'm looking for some nods. I'm not getting any. Please, General Register. Okay, that was enough.
I'm hearing that maybe you're laying it over for possible inclusion.
Okay, maybe we are. I was not clear as to what the motion would be.
All right. So, Representative Gunther moves House File 1116 to be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, in members' packets should be the H1116A4 amendment, if someone would be so good as to move it at this time.
I'll move that amendment.
Thank you.
So, any questions? All those in favor of approving the amendment to get it in the shape the author wants, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1116, excuse me, is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. It has four articles. Article 1 is the policy and includes several small policy changes. Article 2 is a deed housekeeping provision. Chuck Hamilton will discuss those sections. Articles 3 and 4 are the product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is a council made up of legislators, business, labor groups, including the State Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, Mechanical Contractors Association, AFL-CIO, Teamsters, Legal Aid, the Temporary Staffing Association, and your own Representative Gunther. Those articles have minor policy changes and housekeeping changes, and Mr. Nelson is here today to describe those. At this point, I would like to hand the microphone over to Mr. Hamilton to describe Articles 1 and 2, if we could, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Introduce yourself for the
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I'm with DEED. As Representative Dabney has already mentioned, Article 1 is a small grouping of policy changes within DEED. The first two sections relate to the biobusiness development public infrastructure grants, already the subject of this hearing, Senate File 684, which you are moving separately, and I suspect at a point in time we will probably be removing that from this bill. Sections 3 and 4 have to do with the change in the Minnesota Investment Fund, which expands the authorized use of the Minnesota Investment Fund to provide more investment in renewable or green clean energy market development, such as low-interest loans, training grants, and external marketing. I will give you a heads up that the amendment that was passed just a few seconds ago has to do with this section, and it makes it clear from the department's perspective that the leverage, the requirement of match from business does not apply specifically to external marketing for the renewable clean energy market development. If the was required, we had it a little too broad. We needed to narrow that considerably. Section 5 has to do with the state services for the blind, its blind vendor program. We've been advised in our work in that program that we need to make it clear that the blind vendors' employees are not employees of the state and subject to workers' compensation. That has been reviewed through Commerce and Labor. Section 6 is the last policy provision within Article 1. It has to do with the vocational rehabilitation program. It basically streamlines the requirements of local community rehabilitation programs that are requesting extended employment grants, requires audited financial statements. In this section, and in a variety of sections of this bill, there is a lot of reviser style changes that were not requested. We certainly reviewed them, and they didn't make any difference in the policy. It's just an updated style on their part. This is one of those sections that starts that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that ends the general deed policy provision. If there are no questions, Mr. Chairman, I could move to Article 2.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, sir, could you just say a little bit slower that part about the blind workers not being eligible for our workers' compensation and what happens if they are injured on the job?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, this relates to the employees of the blind vendor. I appreciate you asking the question. The blind vendors themselves, under law, rule, and contract, are independent contractors. That's very clear and not at issue. But in the course of the work in a situation that occurred, actually, we were advised by counsel to make it crystal clear that the employees of the blind vendor could not be construed to be employees of the state because we do have a contractual relationship with the blind vendor. We contend that this shouldn't be necessary, but we heed the advice of counsel. There is a particular case going on right now. We don't anticipate this will impact that, but we need to make it clear for the future should something come up again. Blind vendors are aware of this and support.
And Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Go ahead.
And then if the employee of the blind vendor is injured, then that what happens to that employee of the blind vendor?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, under the rules of that program, blind vendors are required to have workers' compensation insurance. And in a particular case, that didn't happen after 70 years in this program. And so that's what prompts this particular bill being brought forward for the future. That situation will be dealt with as any other uninsured situation would be any other employer in the state. And it's working its way through the Department of Labor right now.
Thank you for that clarification.
And I'm sure I was not clear up front.
I think you probably were clear. You were just going so fast.
Any other questions to the testifier? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to Article 1, and I'm looking at Section 3 and 4, and it's talking about lifting the cap on use of the Minnesota Investment Fund. What was kind of the logic behind lifting that cap?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. First of all, there have been a number of events that have pushed the move into the renewable energy area, the green area, and this was really a reaction to that. When it was first drafted, those particular expansions in terms of low-interest loans, training, external marketing were, again, as drafted, exempt from the match requirement the way it was drafted. And that was not the intention. The intention was to use that leverage from participation of private business and others to make the state's money go much further. But the recognition was that in terms of the marketing outreach, that's not usually a project. It's not a matchable kind of activity. It's something that we need to be able to do. I'm told by program staff that this is going to be a large piece, but they're looking for some flexibility. But it's not a matchable piece. That's why they wanted it not subject to that limitation of the 50-50.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to follow. Do you still have Article 2 to do yet?
Yes, I do.
Okay. No, I've got a question when you're done with Article 2.
Any other questions? Do you have another testifier? Mr. Dabney, or I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I could continue with Article 2.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, Article 2 is basically technical and housekeeping. Commissioner McElroy asked us all last fall to take a look at our own statute or in other department statutes where the department was named or involved in a process. We did do that. These have been bolted together over the years with multiple chapters, some addressing similar issues. Most recently, the Department of Economic Security and the Department of Trade and Economic Development merged into the Department of Employment and Economic Development. In this section, there are some common themes that kind of groupings. We're inserting the correct department name, going back a number of years. In at least four places, we're inserting the name Workforce Investment Act or Job Training Partnership Act. In a couple of other cases, we're removing startup language to get a board going, etc. Probably the meat of this area is in Section 5. This has to do with consolidating matters related to fiscal and commissioner's duties. It's on pages 7 through 12. Because the department's been bolted together as things have changed over the years, there were similar or same things in multiple parts of the chapters. The goal here was to try to bring them to one place. We worked very closely with the revisor's office in this regard. It looks like there's a lot of new language in there. That comes from elsewhere. And where that elsewhere was, that's what creates the repealers at the end of the article. And we're prepared to go through those also. Mr. Chairman, with that kind of general overview, I could go through each one of the particular items, or if you'd like to move directly to questions.
Let's go to questions. Representative Mahoney.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple on page 10, line 31.
calls for providing businesses with information on the economic benefit of energy conservation and the availability of energy conservation assistance. I thought as our chair calls it, the Prudhoe Bureau over at Commerce took care of that. Is there a reason why that's in energy is being dealt with in deed, at least the commissioner versus Commerce? 1031.
I do see it, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Representative Mahoney, I must tell you I'm not in a position to respond to that, but it's something that I think the department can get back to you on. Isn't that this bill is going to be laid over anyway?
I've got another question.
Go ahead, Mr.
Mahoney. In light of a couple of things that have come out with other departments on page 11, line 5, promote and encourage expansion and development of markets for Minnesota products, does that entail a lot of traveling? You can get back to me on that one, too. I'll go to the third question.
Okay.
Page 11, line 20. Coordinate the activities of statewide and local planning agencies, correlate information secured from them, from state departments, and suggestions to the planning agencies. Does the department have a plan, and do they kind of work with other areas of the state to coordinate their plan?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think that you're looking for a more global answer than I have, but I could tell you within the division that I particularly am a part of, there is a lot of local planning that goes on related to workforce development. I am sure that there's similar plans related to economic development as well.
I'm more concerned with the first item, with the Commerce
versus... Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we'll take a close look at that.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 10 and line 12, and this is just one item that popped out at me. It's just talking about studying the changes in population and current trends. And we just had the Budget Trend Commission come forth with their study results. Are you looking to work in collaboration with them as well as, already existing state agencies that do this task, or are we going to be doing additional work on top of what's already been done?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm getting the signal that, yes, we do plan on working with them.
Oh, okay, so you're not going to be hiring new staff or starting the process all over when it's already been done, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you have more to present?
Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of homework to do. We'll get back to the committee on those items. But I could defer.
Okay. Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. I would like to talk about Article 3 and Article 4. Article 3 and Article 4 are products of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of a number of groups and a number of legislators, including Representative Dabney, including the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters, the State Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Business, Legal Aid, Temporary Staffing Agency, and others. And there is a consensus which has been reached in regard to each of the changes put forth in Article 3 and Article 4. I'd just like to highlight, I could go through each section. Changes are, I want to say, relatively minor. Two I would like to highlight are Section 11 on page 31. What this does is require employers that file appeals using an agent, whether it be an attorney, an accountant, or one of the large service companies. In other words, they're paying someone to file the appeal for them, and the appeal would have to be filed online. If they do that, then they will automatically schedule the hearing. They can pick their hearing date. This, we believe, will free up two staff people who currently handle that many appeals just on behalf of employers.
to put into more value-added work. We could actually put them on the phone so they can get the wait times down a little less, and they can deal with the issues of adjudication and other issues. We call it value-added rather than simply typing in names and addresses and scheduling a hearing. This way the person could do it all for themselves. And if an employer files an appeal, they can still do it by letter on their own behalf, do it by letter or by fax. But if they're paying someone to do it, that paid person should come in online and do it electronically. Currently, about half of all applicants come in online and file appeals themselves. But getting employers to do it is much more of a struggle. And quite frankly, some of the big service companies and attorneys don't want to do it. You know, we'd like to get them to do it that way. The other thing, two provisions in the I'd like to highlight in the policy provisions are on page 32, section 13. This provides and implements a new penalty on employers who fail or refuse to provide wage information, the information necessary to detect fraud. What happens, an individual may be requesting benefits and then return to a new job. But they keep requesting benefits. Well, the only way we can determine if they actually committed fraud, we have to know the exact week in which they worked, the hours they worked in that week, and how much they were paid in that specific week. We don't have that information on wage detail. It's only submitted quarterly for a whole quarter. So we need this breakdown to determine whether someone committed fraud. Now, we send out 60,000 of these notices a year. Over 20,000 are not returned. So we have no way of determining whether that individual committed fraud, absent going to an on-site visit at the employer and requesting and literally auditing their books. The thought is, how do you get employers to comply? Well, implement a penalty and they will comply. Representative Gunther is the one who said, okay, I think that's a good idea. But he said, I want it very clear on those notices that you send that the penalty is there. So everyone gets this notice, clear. If I don't return it, it's a $100 penalty. And that penalty money would go into the state trust fund. It would not go for administrative funds or other things. It would go into the trust fund, which will ultimately lower employer taxes. But we believe this will get compliance. And again, we have the right to waive any of the penalties. We're not in the penalty business. We're in the compliance business. And all we're trying to do is really get compliance here. The third part I'd like to highlight on the policy provisions is Section 14. On page 33, the department currently has a grant of $5 million from the Department of Labor to help dislocated workers start their own business. But under the unemployment insurance law, they couldn't collect unemployment insurance while doing that. This would allow a waiver, so individuals who are part of this grant process, who are receiving entrepreneurial training through some of our small business centers and entrepreneurial help, they could collect unemployment benefits because the determination is that's the best way for them to get back to work is maybe to start their own business. Now, this is limited to 500 workers, and a worker has to be 50 years of age or older under the federal grant. So it's a very limited project, but we think a very worthwhile one, and we hope it's a success. But it does, in fact, have a sunset on it, but I wanted to highlight that.
Okay. Mr. Nelson, I wonder if you could say a little bit about the changes in Section 5, 6, and 10 of Article 3.
Section 5 on page 26 expands when an applicant may withdraw an application for benefits. Currently, once an individual has served the non-payable waiting week, they cannot withdraw. This would allow an individual to withdraw an account and refile a new one so long as they haven't been paid unemployment benefits. So this would actually expand the number of people who could, in fact, withdraw their accounts by a couple hundred. Now, what happens is an individual may apply for benefits and a week later get a new job, earn a lot more money, and then get laid off 4 months later. They still have an account. Currently, they would not be allowed to withdraw it. Under this bill, they would be allowed to withdraw that account, refile, and then get a higher weekly benefit amount based on their most recent earnings. But we feel it would be very beneficial to a good number of workers who currently, once you serve that waiting week, you can't withdraw, and now they could, so long as they've not been paid benefits. And you said the other sections were?
Section 6 and 10.
6 and 10. Section 6, this was actually brought up by a couple of members who had situations, and Representative Murdoch has a constituent, and he isn't the one who initiated this one, but he is a constituent, and a number of other representatives who have had situations where, for one reason or another, they want to cash in their 401k early. They are less than 59 and a half, and they pay the penalty under the IRS for cashing in their retirement early. But if they do that, they can't collect unemployment benefits. This simply says, if you cash in your retirement account early and pay the penalty under federal law, that it won't affect your unemployment benefits in the future. We think that's a very narrow provision. We imagine, I want to say a handful of people, 10, 12 people a year, but we've had situations where somebody cashed it in to pay serious medical bills, and they were then denied unemployment benefits. And so we think it's a very narrow provision. I'd say we feel, you know, 10 to 15 people a year will benefit, but in some of those cases it has been egregious, and serious medical bills being one of them. And section 10. Section 10 has, I want to say first off, no impact on a worker at all. None. What this does is it deals with temporary staffing agencies. And what happens, a person is hired through a staffing agency on an attempt to hire position. So they go to the client, and all of a sudden, now they're put on permanent by the client. Well, under the law, they would be considered to have been currently discharged by the temporary staffing agency. They didn't quit the temporary staffing agency. What happened? They immediately went into this other job. What this bill does is basically say the temporary staffing agency will, it won't affect their experience rating. That's the reference, what it does is it won't affect their experience rating, and so, in effect, the cost will be socialized. When an individual is working in a staffing agency and immediately goes to work for the client company because they're with the staffing agency on attempt to hire. So it's a very narrow provision trying to deal with a specific situation. It has no impact on a worker at all.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question about the 238 amendment on page 1.1 and 1.4 of the amendment, and it deals with on page 25 of the bill. My concern here, and I'd like some explanation, is the commissioner made any time compromise any unemployment insurance tax or reimbursement due from an employer, and on the amendment it really kind of clarifies that as to an employer that is ceasing operations and/or permanently ceasing operations.
Representative Mahoney, I don't know if you've introduced those amendments yet.
We have not put those in. I thought we put.
We put in one that the author brought, but I think these are brought by someone else. So.
Ah, okay. Then never mind.
Representative Oldenmeyer.
Thank you, Chair. I'll get to those in a minute, Representative Mahoney. Because those are mine. But back to the point, Mr. Nelson, you were making on the top of page 31. With regard to the staffing service issue, Is there any impact on the employee if after they are deemed to have quit the staffing service company, they're then laid off to by the permanent employer? In other words, like 3 weeks later, they're laid off and they have to report who they've had work from and who they haven't received work from.
Mr. Chairman, come over a minute. If you see on lines 4 and 5, accepting employment with the client, staffing service meets the requirements of the exception to ineligibility under that subdivision. So what that says is leaving the staffing service and going to work for the client company is, in effect, quitting for better work. So they are not denied. So it has no impact on the worker. It's considered better work. Leaving from a staffing industry to a permanent job is considered by here just better work.
Okay.
So they are not impacted. That's how they are not impacted, because considered better work under the statute.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question on the compromise language, but I'll hold that off until we hear those amendments. But the other question that I had was regarding the audits on Section 13, and it says in the language here that if they fail to provide a weekly breakdown of money earned by the applicant, what happens if they submit a monthly breakdown? Are they going to be penalized?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, a monthly breakdown is of no value. We can't determine monthly breakdown. We can't determine whether you worked in any given week then or how much you earned in any given week, which is the only way you'd be determined ineligible. I mean, they could say, you know, a person made $1,000 in a month, but we don't know whether the person earned that in 1 week or 4 weeks or 3 weeks or 2 weeks. We couldn't determine whether they committed fraud. It would be of no value. So the only way you can determine it is it's literally a weekly breakdown of the hours worked and how much they actually earned in that week. It's the only way you can detect fraud.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Mr. Nelson, so is that clearly stated in the notice that is sent out as well?
Mr. Chairman, the current notice says is literally each day, and you write down the amount of hours the person worked in each individual day, and then the total earnings for the week. So we're asking for each day they literally work, because then what we do is send that to the applicant and basically say, here's the information we've received from the employer. Now, you reported you weren't working. You reported you had no earnings. Here's what we just received from the employer. They said you were working on this day, worked this many hours, and here's how much you earned for the week. What do you have to say? That's what we ask the applicant. And sometimes we find out that the employer was mistaken. Usually they don't respond and determined to be fraud. And they can appeal from that and go to a hearing if they do choose. But and that's how you determine whether they choose fraud. Because they are asked each week when they file a continued request for benefits, did you work? If they say yes, then we ask, how much did you make? Divide your earnings. And how they are caught, if you will, they're turned in. We have a tip line. We get tips all the time, people. Usually we have a cross match when wage detail comes in quarterly. We have a cross match, so it shows how much they earned in a quarter. We find out, see, they collected 13 weeks of unemployment benefits that quarter, but they made $10,000 that quarter. Something's not matching up. And that's when we start sending these out. And again, we send 60,000 of these out because there is some question. I could give you the threshold numbers, but I don't want to state that publicly. What exactly we do on those cross matches, but I certainly point that out to you in your office anytime. It's exactly how it's done.
Any other questions? Do you want to continue with the Article 4 then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Article 4 is pure housekeeping. No individual is granted benefits under that particular section, and no person is denied benefits under that section, is called pure housekeeping. I do want to point out two sections on page 38. What happened on page 38, which is section 12, is the United States Department of Labor held this out of conformity with federal law. And under the authority of the commissioner in 268.23, the language was stricken from the statute. It has no force in effect. The commissioner has the power, if the Department of Labor rules it out of conformity, to strike its enforcement. So it hasn't been enforced for about a year and a half, so we're simply asking that it be taken out of the statute because it has no force in effect. I do want to also point out page 49 and 50, and while that is, appears to be new language, it actually, while it's new language, it's not a new concept. What happened when I drafted this and gave it to the reviser, I did a strikeout, but there were so many strikeouts that the reviser repealed the section 268.086 and redid it as 268.085. They eliminated a lot of the things which were obsolete in the old provision, and so this is simply a rewrite of that section. While it appears new, it is not new. There is a repeal of the current 268.086. Those are the two portions of the technical housekeeping provisions I'd like to highlight.
Any questions? Seeing none, proceed with whatever else we have to do here.
The motion was to delay it over.
Okay. Representative Obermiller, did you want to bring the amendments that you were...
Sure, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple here, and I want to first start off by saying that kind of short hurts Mr. Nelson here a bit, and I apologize for that. I worked late in the evening trying to, you know, get the language I just wanted to have looked at today, and he's had a couple of suggestions, which I do appreciate. And perhaps, Mr. Chair, the couple of ones that I think, I don't know what order to take them in, but could we take the 238 amendment first, and I'll move that amendment, please?
Do all members have that in front of them? AO90238. Do you want to move that amendment?
I do move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And
you want to speak to it first?
If I could, please. Yeah. Some of these may need some discussion, and that's, and I appreciate that. And I think Mr. Nelson may have some comments as well, which I'm happy to take. But you know, the purpose of this amendment just deals with the way the department deals with collecting taxes that aren't being paid in a timely manner. And one of the things that happens in these cases is, as I understand from talking to Mr. Nelson, is that sometimes businesses are going down and there's a chance to collect a little bit of the tax revenue that might otherwise be lost as the business is failing. And so they want to be able to compromise to do that. And so the first kind of change to the amendment is to say that, you know, if you can compromise these plans, but you have to be doing that. The only time we're going to let you just kind of carte blanche compromise them is if the business is going down. Then the other two, putting back in the language that's been stricken up till now, is really about a determination about who's making that determination, and whether it's going to be the commissioner or some random staff person or an attorney. And so putting the language back in C, which is line 25, 32 through 34, basically says we're going to, when we're going to compromise, we're going to give up the claim that's a big claim over $2,500. We're going to make sure that someone licensed to practice law is involved in that compromise. And so then the last one is on page 41 and line 22. And that issue, I had to get there too, I apologize. Deals with how we collect basically there's an attorney's fee provision in the statute now, and I think the department's probably been very good about this, and that this isn't an issue that's ever actually used very often anyway. And what my change here at line 1.7 and 1.8 of the amendment would basically do is say that when you got an employer or someone who's committed fraud, we're going to stick you with attorney's fees if we got to come and collect. But if we've got an employee who's been overpaid unemployment benefits and then they just, you know, ultimately lose, it turns out they actually had quit or they were discharged for cause, that we're not going to, and they haven't paid it back or they can't pay it back, that we're not going to also stick them with the attorney's fees on top of that. So that's the basic portion of the amendment.
Any questions? Representative Mahoney.
I'm glad Representative Overmiller brought this back. Overmiller brought this amendment forward because I am kind of concerned about the commissioner having carte blanche to not go after the taxes that are owed to the state, and this kind of this definitely limits it. Which is good. My question for Mr. Nelson is, do you have any idea how much the in a typical year the commissioner might forgive? Any examples of the last few years what might have been forgiven in terms of unemployment taxes or uncollected?
Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman, Mahoney, I guess I don't want to say off the top of my head I do, but it's not, I don't think it's as encompassing as what you're getting at. We write off a lot of tax because it simply goes unpaid after 6 years, we write it off. If you're talking about the particular provisions on how much is compromised, you know, because the individual who does all the compromises, quite frankly, works for me, and he is an attorney, which I'll comment about that in a moment. How much is uncollected? One difficulty you have is this. Employers don't file their tax reports. They don't file wage detail. And so what we do, if they refuse to file it, we ultimately just estimate it and send them a bill. And then we try to collect on that bill. So some of that is, if I want to call it phantom, we're just guessing how much the taxes are owed. And, you know, so that's one example of how much one case we may compromise. Or say, I'm no longer in business, but I'll give you, you know, 25 cents on the dollar, and here's all the money I got, and they present some financial statements. We may take it, because we don't know how much, absent going out and actually looking at those records, how much of the taxes are actually due. The business is already closed up. We may compromise those out. But I can get those information for you, exactly the breakdown of each of those. But Mr. Chairman, if I might comment on the proposed amendment, I'll give an example and I'll be blunt. There's a rather large trucking courier company and operates nationally that was determined by the department to have employees and assessed back taxes, who said, here, you owe taxes for the prior 3 years. Were approached by their attorneys in Washington and from Tennessee, which I met with. They want to compromise that because they say they've changed their business model. We want to deal with issues going forward. We want to compromise all back taxes. Under this particular amendment, the way it's drafted, we couldn't do that. We could not compromise that issue. These are back taxes from 3 or 4 years ago. We couldn't do it. We would have to say, no. You have to pay it all, or we're going to litigate the whole thing. We can't compromise it out, no matter even if it was in some sort of lawsuit. We could never compromise. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a good idea. That's just simply one example of that. As to the about attorneys, I sign compromises, and they're handed to me by one of our accountants. that do these on our auditor or accountants. I can prove it. Now you're saying, just what you think I'll be done. He says, yeah, I sign it. Absent my doing it myself, I don't have any way of knowing anything about it. Now you're forcing us, hiring a particular person to do that, and that may not be the best individual. I mean, the individuals to do these are sometimes auditors we've had for 20-some years. I'm not sure simply because you have a law license that that makes you more competent than an auditor who's been doing it for 20 years. A law license doesn't give you any specific expertise at all. You know, compelling the commissioner to have an attorney to sign these documents, I'm not sure that that adds any value to it. Currently, chief compromise officer is an accountant and an attorney. He works for me. That's who the individual we would continue to use, but I don't know that you need statutory requirements that somebody sign it, because all it's going to do is be a signature, because I don't have any way of going back on some of the smaller ones who he doesn't do, some of the auditors present to me. I don't have any way of looking, is that the best? Are these figures real? And did you question the business? Is that a good determination? I have to trust the auditor. And I don't know why my signing it makes any difference. That's my only comment. That's why it was removed. Having a law license didn't give you any particular expertise.
Professor Mahoney, do you have any further questions?
Well, I could, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, we sign some things around here. We're generally not fiscal compromises, but you know, I tend to read most of the letters that my staff ask me to sign, just in case, just in case that aggravated my staff and they were trying to get even. But I would expect you to ask the auditor. I mean, depending on the dollar figure, I mean, if it's a $50 bill, wouldn't expect you to send it. It would cost the state more than what we're paying you, probably in the end, to take too much time with that. But at $2,500, to ask, you know, how did you come to this? I would expect you to do that, and I'd expect anybody to do that, and to have a second signature or someone else do the work and a second person to go over it. You know, we have a history recently in this state of not having enough auditors. I think the Department of Management and Budget just had to commit to hiring 6 or 8 new ones. So I don't have a real problem with this amendment. It's an amendment, and we should put it on.
No.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I guess that reinstating that certain language would not be particularly problematic. It is problematic, however, 3 and 4. Which would limit the ability to compromise only the businesses who are actually out of business or going out. Then we couldn't compromise any of the bad taxes. We'd have to litigate those issues completely. And I'm not sure going to somebody we can't settle. We have to litigate it. It's always the best alternative. Right? Getting them rolling the dice and getting nothing. We may get nothing. And you know, sometimes getting something is, you know, if you don't have a particularly great case, maybybe better than nothing. So you're basically saying we can't turn over to the lawyers again. You can't settle with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, I appreciate the explanation on the stricken language regarding the $2,500 amount. That makes sense to me that we, you know, don't have an attorney to do it. And but to address Representative Mahoney's concerns of having somebody else sign off on it, I think that would be maybe some helpful language. I don't think it needs to be an attorney. I respect your views that it could be anybody that's within the office that has expertise in that area. But I did want to get to Representative Overmiller on your amendment. I just wanted some clarification because I thought I heard you say this, but can you just talk about line 1.7 on your amendment? Explain that again, exactly what you're trying to do there when you're striking the word person and inserting the other language.
Go ahead, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, under the current law, any person who hasn't paid, and person would include both an employer or a applicant, you can come back after them and get attorney's fees and costs and a certain, and you know, all the items listed there in the statute. And what this would say is we're carving out basically the person who was an applicant who did not commit fraud under the statute. In other words, a lot of times you get an unemployment claim, you get paid, but then you get overpaid and you have to pay it back and you can't, and that's the situation we'll be doing.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to say?
One comment on this, on that portion I'm trying to put back in. The statute already requires you to authorize the settlement of the compromise, not just to sign it. So that's an important piece to me, to make sure someone is looking over the shoulder to make sure we're doing that right. And with regard to, you know, going down in business, I think from my perspective as a policy, we ought to be saying if we're going to pursue a claim, it's okay to waive off the fees and the penalties and so forth to get a case settled, but the taxes themselves should stay in place. So I don't necessarily have to share the concerns that Mr. Nelson does, and I do think that the department still has the discretion not to pursue the claim or not to pursue a particular year of the claim. And so I think that you could say, well, we're gonna sue you for this most recent year, and you can't compromise that piece of it, and then the other parts would just get barred off by the statute of limitations that are turning the bill. So I appreciate the support for the bill, or for the amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think as I hear Representative Miller speak, particularly the provision on 1.3 and 1.4, I think I'm about 75% of the way there. I mean, certainly the principle of the taxes should be paid is agreed, but I also recognize in the real world, sometimes unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your today, compromises must be made. And I'm wondering if you aren't creating a situation where the department would have to choose either all or nothing. And they could pursue for a year of unpaid taxes and only agree to 100% of the unpaid taxes, or they could agree, or they could decide not to pursue for that year at all. And I'm not sure we're better off if that's the only choices. If yes or no are the only choices that we are offering them, as opposed to what about 60 cents on the dollar for that year, if that's the best we can get.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to divide the amendment between lines 1.6 and 1.7.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Anderson, would you consider including dividing instead between 1.4 and 1.5?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't include the 1.5 line because I'm not sure striking that language is, because I did listen to Mr. Nelson, and I don't necessarily think it has to be an attorney. I do think it's important to maybe have a second person sign off, but I don't know if we want to really incur the cost of an attorney when we have experts within the department that could serve that same purpose. And that's the only reason why I don't like that piece. But I understand Mahoney's concerns and Representative Omer Miller's concerns there. So that's why I don't include that in the division.
Okay. Members, we have before us a motion to divide the amendment at lines 1.6 and 1.7 between those two. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
I don't think it carried.
Mr.
Division.
Okay. All right. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I would. Representative Anderson has asked for a division. I think I got to it first. So we'll go to my question here. And my comment is, I think there may be some problems with this amendment, but the concept of it, of uncontrolled compromises, the ability for the commissioner to make unregulated compromises is a little disconcerting to me. But I'm sure, having worked with Mr. Nelson in the past, he's a pretty good wordsmith and can find a few ways to get around this. And either if it's going to the floor, I think, or in a conference committee, they can come back with some language that might serve both people's groups, both sides of this issue. Because I am a little not distrustful, that's the wrong word, uncomfortable with the idea that there's not some strings attached. I guess we're all getting too many strings attached to things in this world nowadays, but I do want the commissioner to understand that I'd rather have 60 cents on the dollar than 25 cents on the dollar.
Did you want to respond to... You called for a division, I want to resolve that. But I also have a suggestion that perhaps, since we're running out of time, maybe it would be useful for you to visit about the amendment and bring it back another time. Would that make sense?
Yes, I would withdraw my division. If we can go that route, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, you're asking that I'll withdraw the amendment for now and bring it back the next time around. I'm happy to talk about it, but we can do that fine.
Okay.
I think we're coming back, laying over here.
We are laying it over, yes.
Okay. As long as I'm getting a chance to put it back on, I'm the new guy here, so I don't want to lose my window of opportunity here, but that I'll withdraw the amendment 238 and see if we can work on compromise language on that.
Okay, you have three other amendments?
Mr. Chair, the other one that I think we really should try to work through today, though, is the A9-239, and Mr. Chair, I'll move that be adopted.
Okay, and you wish to explain it.
And Mr. Chair, that actually have an oral amendment that Mr. Nelson is, I don't think he agrees with the policy behind, but was still kind enough to fix my fix some things. And so a quick oral amendment, if I may, and that, which I'll incorporate, is that line 1.13, we're going to strike the new text and strike the words burden of proof.
Okay, and you are incorporating that.
Right, and I'm sorry, I got just a few more words here. And on line 2.1, after the comma, we're going to strike everything after the comma. And on line 2.2, strike the word construe. And then at the end of that sentence, add the words must be narrowly construed. So I'll read that for you. It'll say now that in determining eligibility or ineligibility for benefits, any statutory provision that would preclude an applicant from receiving benefits must be narrowly construed. And thank you, Mr. Nelson, for that. The reason for that change is that the unemployment law judge apparently doesn't make the determination at the initial stage. It's just a staff member who I'm sure is making a quality one, but we want to make sure that they're doing it the right way. And the purpose for the, and I'll incorporate that amendment, Mr. Chair, and then just explain the purpose of this amendment is, right now we take a position that it's a 50-50 shot. You're exactly equal whether you're entitled to benefits or not entitled to benefits. And prior to, at least prior to 1997, but maybe a bit later than that, we had some case law in Minnesota that said you were presumed to be entitled to benefits. And the cases went along the line of saying that this kind of a statute is humanitarian and remedial in nature, and that persons who aren't unemployed through a fault that they did should be granted benefits unless they're disqualified, and that we narrowly construe the disqualification provisions. And so what this does is it says when those individual staff members are looking at the information that comes in on the computer, that they have to presume you're eligible unless there's something on the paper that says you're not eligible. And the same is true with the ULJ and down the line as well. So basically, we're gonna give a tie to the employee in this situation.
Okay. Any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The amendment carries. Okay, any other business with this? Seeing none, Representative, who was it?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess there's a point of parliamentary inquiry. If you move to lay it over at this time, is that, since there are still amendments that have been floating around, are you laying it over to take up again at a later time, or are you laying it over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill?
approximate.
I'm just trying to understand the process, sir.
I think it means that we'll lay it over and we'll take it up again before inclusion so that you have a chance to review it.
I get to come back.
Okay. Where's the easement?
Couldn't we just move to lay it on the table and then we just take a motion and take it off the table at our next meeting? Is that how you would do it?
Mr. Chair?
President Dabney.
The only hesitancy is the author I would have to an actual motion to lay it on the table. Is that that then requires an affirmative vote to bring it up off the table, while if the chair simply uses his prerogative to lay it over, the chair retains his prerogative to bring it back at a later time at his discretion.
I think we're okay with the way we're doing it too. And it was Representative Gunther renews his motion to lay this over. To hold it over for possible inclusion. But as I said before, we will review it again before it goes to that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. And, oh, yes, the minutes. Miller, will you make a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have moved the minutes of our most recent meeting.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.